Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I am your host, Dr. Michael Wangwa. Today, we are going to be discussing Rwandan election and autocratic democracies in Africa. I'm joined by a very special guest, Professor Philip Regens. Professor Philip is Emeritus Professor of Law and Politics at the Institute of Development Policy, University of Antwerp. Philip, I'm very pleased to have you join me today, and I look forward to our conversation.
It's my pleasure being with you, Michael.
Brilliant. So Rwanda has recently had an election where Paul Kagame has won his fourth consecutive presidential, so with a landslide victory. What do you make of this? Does this move democracy forward? Is it something we should applaud, or is it something that doesn't, is it positive or negative? How do you see this victory and this election?
Well, first of all, I should remind your listeners that Paul Kagame now starts his fourth presidential term. He has had 7 years presidential terms, and now he starts his first five-year term, and he can run for a second five-year term after that. That would make it a total of five terms. This is, by the way, not really exceptional in Africa. We've seen countries where presidential term limits have been well observed, but we've also seen other countries where constitutional amendments have overturned the principle of presidential terms. For instance, new constitutions were adopted, and then the system started from zero again. In other words, the previous terms didn't count, and the incumbent president would embark on a first term. So, I mean, this is not exceptional. What is quite exceptional, and what reminds the era of one-party states in Africa, is that Paul Kagame got, according to the latest results — they're not totally final yet, but the latest results are that he obtained 99.18% of the votes. Of course, that comes pretty close to the 100% outcomes we've seen under one-party states until the early 1990s. And of course, it expresses a reality in Rwanda. This is, although there are several parties, even some several parties represented in parliament, but this is de facto a one-party state. And the proof is actually that all political parties in Rwanda, including what they call the opposition parties, have supported Paul Kagame's bid for the presidency. There's only one party, and that's the only party that's not part of the Rwanda Patriotic Front's cartel of parties, namely the Democratic Green Party of Rwanda, has fielded its own candidate, Frank Habineza. But he and another candidate, an independent candidate, got under 0.5% of the votes. I mean, this doesn't sound particularly serious. What we also know is that people simply are not confident that their vote will be confidential. Many voters, like in some other African countries, use their thumbprints to mark their preference on the ballot paper. Now, in Rwanda, like in other countries, a thumbprint is like a signature. Illiterate people who have to sign documents use their thumbprints. So in other words, it is for them as if they signed their ballot paper with their name. And although it would be technically impossible to check all those thumbprints and to see who voted for an opposition candidate, people are certainly not convinced that the vote is confidential. And of course, as the RPF is so dominant, controls all the institutions of the state and the security services and the local administrations, for people it's considered extremely risky to be seen as an opponent. And we've seen that when looking at what happened to those who were real or suspected opponents. Many people have been arrested and jailed, have been tried and received long prison sentences. Some have been killed, some have disappeared, and many have actually fled abroad. So it's although it's formally speaking on paper, according to the Constitution, it is a multi-party state, it is in effect a one-party state, and the result of Paul Kagame, 99.18%, shows that very well.
Very interesting. There's so many things you mentioned that I'll come back to, but I want to ask this question. So a lot of people have looked at Rwanda from 94, from the genocide, and maybe they have seen how Rwanda arguably has made some significant or considerable progress. One can argue that. And do you think that in itself plays, because Paul Kagame has prioritized development, national development, and it looks like that offsets political freedom, that offsets human rights, upholding human rights. It looks like that offset. Do you agree with this kind of like juxtaposition with the economic progress that have been made since 94, mm-hmm. and the kind of obviously lack of political freedom that we have in our country?
Yes, indeed, this contradiction is very typical of Rwanda, because basically you have two Rwandas. You have a Rwanda where bureaucratic or technocratic governance is very good, actually. Rwanda has made great progress in health indicators, in economic growth, of course. It has been considered a leader in how you can do business. So there's certainly a lot of vision and ambition in the RPF, in the Rwanda Patriotic Front, or inside the party. And this is extrapolated throughout the whole country. So in other words, in technocratic, bureaucratic terms, this is a success story compared to many other African countries. It is also in a region where states tend to be weak. It's a real state. It's a strong state that is able to perform all basic functions of sovereignty of the state, territorial integrity, administrative control, including the population in all sorts of bureaucratic endeavors. So there's no doubt about that. If you compare, for instance, Rwanda, because that's very much topical these days, if you compare Rwanda, which in a sense is at war with neighboring Democratic Republic of Congo, I mean, the Rwandan army is operating in a covert fashion, but is operating in the DRC. They have troops there and they support a rebel movement, the M23, for over 2 years now. And that is possible in the DRC because there's virtually no state. I mean, the essential functions of sovereignty of the Congolese state are not performed, or at least are not performed very well. So that's a big difference. Rwanda is a real state. This is due to the efforts of the RPF, but it is also an old feature of Rwanda. This is not an artificial state. I mean, it was not created by colonial rule, and like many other African states, Rwanda is, although it was smaller in pre-colonial days, but is a pre-colonial reality. So the notion of a state, the whole philosophy of a state, is very much present in Rwanda and has been so for, well, I would say for centuries already. So that is the paradox. You have on the one hand this good bureaucratic governance, and on the other hand, a deeply flawed political governance. It's not just because there's no opposition, but there's no freedom of speech. There is no freedom of association. There's no freedom of assembly. There's no freedom to demonstrate unless the RPF calls for a demonstration. And that creates a great deal of frustration among many Rwandans, and not just elite Rwandans. And I should add, not just because Rwanda, of course, as you rightly pointed out, is associated with the genocide against the Tutsi. And so the ethnic problem, if so to speak, or the ethnic phenomenon in Rwanda is always mentioned when one talks about Rwanda. And when we do that, we tend to think in terms of Hutu versus Tutsi, the Hutu being the large majority, some 85% or 90% of the population, and the Tutsi 10 to 15%. Now, the current regime is completely dominated by Tutsi. I made a study, published a study about a year ago, based on the identification of office holders of the 200 most important offices in Rwanda, functions in Rwanda, in the political sphere, but also in the press, civil society, the churches, etc. And what I found out, and that is not contested actually by the regime, what I found out is that 80% of all those functions are occupied by Tutsi. Now, I'm saying that because what one sees is that not just Hutu opponents are threatened, but also, and increasingly so, and actually already so since 2000, for the last almost 25 years, mainly Tutsi opponents. So in other words, you have a Tutsi-dominated regime, but the repression is not on an ethnic basis, not along ethnic lines, but along political lines. If you're an opponent, Hutu or Tutsi, you are threatened. And you may even be, this is pretty well documented, the capacity of extraterritorial repression by the Rwandan regime abroad, in not just neighboring countries, but even in European countries, for instance, in the UK, has been well demonstrated. So the a leading opponent who used to be the chief of Rwandan intelligence, Colonel Karegeya, was assassinated in South Africa, where he was in exile. I think it was end of 2013, early 2014, and he was a Tutsi, and he used to be a major office holder in the Rwandan regime in an absolutely central function, meaning intelligence. And he was assassinated, most likely, I mean, all the indications are there, by this apparatus of extraterritorial repression. There's been a report out last year or 2 years ago by Freedom House, which documents this very well and puts Rwanda in the same league as countries like Russia, Iran, Turkey, a number of other countries having a very active extraterritorial repression system. And Rwanda was also among the few countries mentioned in the investigations surrounding the use of Pegasus spyware, which infects people's smartphones. And this is an Israeli the Israeli built device, and Rwanda was among the clients, and Rwanda has used this to infect and penetrate people's smartphones. So in other words, this is the dilemma of Rwanda, you see. And one of the concerns people like me who have been studying Rwanda for many years, one of the concerns we have is that the achievements of good bureaucratic governance may actually be undone by this flawed political governance.
Hmm. Very interesting there. And I want to take it a bit wider, look at it in terms of like, you mentioned the, like in most African countries, are arbitrarily created by the colonial government. And some have argued, even in my book as well, have argued where countries like Botswana, for instance, had that homogeneity compared to most African states. And we've not seen that level of kind of like political repression, but we've seen obviously economic growth that we can say, you know, is consistent with what we're seeing with countries that have that homogeneous states. But we can also then argue about Somalia as well. That seems to have a bit of some homogeneous kind of like entity. Mm-hmm. But what I want to talk about is the autocratic, the complicity of, if you like to say, like maybe Western partners or other partners. You've mentioned Israel, for instance. We could also put the United States. We could put, because Rwanda, like Raleigh said, plays a very important geopolitical role, stabilization role in the region, whether mm-hmm. in Mozambique, whether in DRC, whether in Uganda. And by virtue of this, it gets support recently with the UK migration deal and all of that. Do you think, in a way, that Rwanda, and I can also throw in Uganda as well, Museveni there, and mm-hmm. say, do you think this authority that emboldened, maybe due to maybe counterterrorism policies of the United States, and they are great partners in these counterterrorism policies, do you think that emboldens them? Do you think, in a way, the West or other kind of external partners inadvertently, we could use that, support this kind of political repression or authoritarian stance in Rwanda and other states?
Can I, Michael, before I address your question, which is a really very pertinent one, can I... Mm. Just because you mentioned Botswana, right? Ethnically homogeneous countries. There are a few in Africa, not that many, because, of course, the African states, but Botswana is not one of them. Neither is Lesotho, for instance. Most of those countries have been created by, well, artificial borders have been drawn in Africa, and those have brought groups together that had no previous contacts, or sometimes rather hostile contacts. This is an interesting question because all the research that I know shows that homogeneous situations like the one in Botswana, for instance, but you also mentioned Mozambique, Somalia.
Yes, Somalia.
Seems to be a counter example of what I'm going to say, but that if you have either multipolar situation, i.e. you have dozens and sometimes even hundreds of ethnic groups living in a country, you have dozens in Kenya, you have hundreds in the DRC, for instance, there is little major ethnic, there is some ethnic favoritism, nepotism, etc., but there are no civil wars based on ethnic identities. And you don't see that in a country like Botswana either, of course. So what one sees is that bipolar ethnic situations where you have only two ethnic groups or two main ethnic groups give rise to conflict and potentially violent conflict. And of course, 1994, the genocide against Tutsi in Rwanda was the most horrendous example of violent conflict, of course. So if you have a bipolar situation, and this is not just the case in Africa. In Africa, you find that, for instance, in Rwanda, obviously, also in Burundi, also Hutu and Tutsi. But you find the same phenomenon elsewhere in the world. Greeks versus Turks in Cyprus. Mm. Protestants versus Catholics in Northern Ireland. Dutch speakers versus French speakers in Belgium. Those are bipolar ethnic, let's call them ethnic, you could call them identity group situations that are difficult to manage, while multipolar situations or unipolar homogeneous situations are much easier to manage, although those countries may have other dividing or sources of division and conflict, obviously. Now, to return to your question, to your initial question, Rwanda has been, for the last, I would say, 20 years or so, punching well above its weight. This is a very small, very poor country with a population of about 13 million, with a GDP of about $15 billion, which is very, very small. So it's a small, poor country, and yet it has succeeded. And this, again, is a consequence of vision and ambition that I mentioned before. They have shown themselves to be, I wouldn't say, they operate militarily, because they have a great deal of military diplomacy. They operate militarily in countries as far apart as Mozambique, where they still have thousands of service people, but also in Central African Republic, for instance. And this is very often in the Rwandan case combined, I would say, military diplomacy with economic diplomacy. This is not just military deployment, it is also seizing economic opportunities, for instance, in the mining sector. Again, the deployment, which is a covert in Central African Republic and Mozambique, the deployment of the Rwandan army is public. It's public knowledge. The Rwandans boast about it, actually. The deployment of 3,000 to 4,000 Rwandan troops in the DRC is covert. It is denied by Kigali consistently, although the UN group of experts on the DRC keeps documenting the Rwandan military presence and its support for the M23 rebel movement. But at the same time, Rwanda also, through middlemen, generally not directly exploit Congolese resources. And they are smuggled in large quantities into Rwanda, and from Rwanda they reach the international markets, including through Dubai in particular. And so, in other words, the money that is available for the regime, for instance, to fund this extraterritorial repression, because that's pretty expensive, and to fund those that military presence abroad, in part at least, that those means come from the exploitation of resources in the DRC. Just like it comes from exploitation of resources in the Central African Republic. So, in other words, this is again this paradoxical combination of punching above your weight and doing all sorts of things that would be unacceptable, would be considered unacceptable. Now, they can do it, and the example you gave with the UK is, of course, a very good one. The UK became, under the previous government, this has disappeared now after Labour has taken over, but they have signed this asylum deal with Rwanda, and illegal immigrants who came into the UK would be deported to Rwanda, where their files would be treated, where they would in the meantime be housed. No one exactly knows how Rwanda would be able to accommodate thousands of migrants, but hundreds certainly they could. And this, in a sense, took the conservative government, Rishi Sunak, but also its predecessors like Boris Johnson, they became hostages of the Rwandan regime, because they needed Rwanda to make what Rishi Sunak would call stop the boats, remember? Rwandan support and the implementation by Rwanda of that deal was essential for the UK government. And so, in other words, contrary to other countries, the UK stopped criticizing Rwanda, for instance, for its human rights record inside the country, but also for its operations in countries like the DRC. So it has sheltered Rwanda from criticism. And my guess is actually that under the new Labour government in the UK, the UK will become much, will feel much freer to express what they really feel about Rwanda's behavior, both inside and outside the country. So in other words, the Conservative defeat in the UK is very bad news for the Rwanda Patriotic Front.
I agree with you. Earlier you mentioned one party system, and it's no exception in Rwanda. So if you look at the history of African states, and look at when they gained independence from the 60s and how they've tried different political systems from Nkrumah and all of that, starting with the one-party system, the parliamentary system, then the military dictatorship and all of that. You mentioned about the contradiction, the paradox in Rwanda, how on the bureaucratic front, they're making sense, but on the other side. So there's been that also paradox of neo-patrimonialism, and also, you know, the bureaucratic state, which is all the consequence or legacy of colonialism, and you know what we see. So there's always been that debate, that persistent debate in Africa about the right system to adopt, the what democracy, what is election. And you mentioned about Tom printing as well. In Nigeria, for instance, with the last election, they wanted to do the electronic voting. But that in its work as well offered hope, but it didn't stop the manipulation of the political elite. So I guess my question is, should Africa, its liberal democracy, like election or constitutional democracy, one that focuses more on election, is it a good thing for Africa? Should Africa start looking at other kind of alternative or find a way to tweak it? Is that the problem? Is that a source of problem? Because we can look at Rwanda, for instance, and say, well, they can say, we're doing elections every year, but those elections are not free and fair.
Well, the experience in Africa post-1990, after the fall of the Berlin Wall, after the end of the Cold War, which seems to be resuming now, but anyway, the experience is that the idea was, and that is what the Rwandan government would say, we need to build this country and we can't afford all sorts of, we can't afford wasting our time and potentially creating conflict because of an effective liberal democracy. Remember, that was also the argument used by leaders before 1990 to justify one-party states. I mean, you had one party, and that party brought together the entire people, and we have no time to waste on all sorts of divisions. That was basically the argument used for one-party states. So Rwanda is, although claiming it is a multi-party state, is actually using the same argument to justify a very restricted political space. The argument that you cannot have economic progress or development and liberal democracy at the same time is contradicted by so many examples, not just across the world, but even in Africa. If you look at countries like, well, take Ghana, for instance. This is a country that practices liberal democracy. I wouldn't say it's perfect, but liberal democracy in my own country, Belgium, is not perfect either. And there is not one model of liberal democracy. There you can fill that in or fill that out in different ways. And it doesn't. And actually, to show how limiting this idea of one version of liberal democracy is, in all our countries, our democracies of today are different from our democracy 50 years ago. And in 50 years' time, they will be different again. I mean, there is not one ideal model of liberal democracy. The problem is that, well, it's not a problem. The experience is, again, that a number of, when we limit ourselves to Africa, that there are a number of African countries where liberal democracy functions pretty well, where presidents respect term limits. After two terms, they go. Where opposition parties win elections and take over majority in parliaments. That exists in Africa today, not before 1990, but today. And those countries are not worse in economic terms than autocratic systems today or in the past.
Very, very good. Very, 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 very good observation. To mention Ghana, you mentioned Ghana. Ghana is like a very nice example to mention. But we've seen, maybe that could be another extreme as well. We've seen the Sahel states. We've seen where with the return of coup in the Sahel states and you know, former French African countries. Yeah. And if you put a lot of people saying, and you rightly mentioned as well, the return of another Cold War. We've seen Russia in there, Russia and see in Central African Republic and Russia in all of these places as well. And so I'm just looking, what is the future of Africa? Because, you know, with Western nations such as the United States, such as France, taking a backseat or being kicked out from some of these states, what do you project for democracy or project for political systems in Africa? And then we have Russia, we also have other Middle states like Turkey, you have Iran, you have all of these states, China. Yeah. What do you see? Are we obviously this is a new Cold War, but I think it's wider than that. What do you see? How do you project Africa in going forward?
First of all, I should say that I'm not a Sahel specialist. And so I follow the Sahel just like I follow the rest of Africa. So I'm not an expert. But you point at something that is, there are several aspects here. And you point at something, for instance, that I think is important and underestimated. It is the fact that powers that are foreign to Africa are causing conflict because it's in their interest. Sudan is a very good example where you can see Middle Eastern countries supporting this or that faction in Darfur, for instance, causing untold human suffering, untold death, displacement, people running away to Chad in their hundreds of thousands, even millions. I mean, and this is to some extent, of course, there is a responsibility of Sudanese politicians and military, no doubt about that. But this is, these conflicts are only possible and are only possible, or only the size they develop is possible because of foreign interventions for own egoistic, if you want, collectively egoistic political goals. Like, for instance, as I said, countries, several countries from the Gulf region, for instance, that are enemies, they're not fighting wars, but they're opponents, and they support opponent factions in Sudan, for instance. The Sahel is a similar example. You have the, what we've seen, and this is not a recent phenomenon, it's an old phenomenon, that the Cold War has remained cold in Europe. I mean, we haven't seen any war except since
Ukraine,
slightly over 2 years in Ukraine, but we haven't seen any wars during those decades of Cold War. So the war in Europe has remained cold. Unfortunately, the Cold War has been very hot outside of Europe. In Latin America, we've seen the Americans fighting the Soviet Union, then in countries like El Salvador, Nicaragua, and others. In Africa, in Angola, in Mozambique, in many other countries, and you see the same thing again. So the operations of semi-official Russian, let me call them security agencies, the former Wagner Group, for instance, have played a role in, have tried to create space for themselves. For instance, by, and I can understand the anti-French feeling there is in certain parts of West Africa and the Sahel, and anti-American feelings. I mean, Americans are forced, not militarily, but they're basically politically forced to close down their military bases in that region. We'll have to see. You asked me to forecast something that I cannot forecast. We'll have to see, for instance, what the three military leaders in the Sahel, who have now created their own sort of confederation, will mean. When I see those images of those three men in military attire, basically ready to fight a war, if you see them on a podium, I'm quite concerned. We'll have to see how they will manage. Can they lead a country? Can they create better living conditions for their populations? Is the more independence from Western powers, will this turn out to be, for instance, economically a good thing or not? We don't know that yet. What African countries do increasingly do, and I think they're absolutely right, is to make sure that added value is increasingly created in Africa. What Africa did in the past was basically export, say, raw materials. Again, the DRC is such a good example. The country has basically been plundered by both international mining companies, international players, states, and also, of course, the elites, the national domestic elites, because we forget too often that there is a coalition, although that's not explicitly expressed as such, but there is a coalition between those foreign exploiters and domestic exploiters. Because if there were no domestic exploiters, the external exploiters would not be able to do what they do. So, and this is again, I think, the whole issue of what can democracy bring? I mean, if people are made these elites that exploit their own populations, that live lavish lifestyles, I mean, when their own populations are starving to death from hunger and diseases, they can do that only because they are supported, so to speak, or they do that in cahoots with international players. This would change in a truly democratic system, because those elites would be then called to account during elections by their populations. And their populations would say they would then rather vote for someone promising to put an end to this exploitative economy. And then you'd have to see whether they'd fulfill their promises, of course. But that is true for all our politicians. We'll have to see what Trump promises and later does. And we'll have to see what perhaps Kamala Harris will promise and do in the United States. But again, there, as the saying goes, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. And returning to the Sahel, the three Sahel military leaders, it's much too early, to call. It's too close to call, you know. We'll have to see in... Ask me the question again in 5 years' time, then I think.
Let me. I'm going to ask the last question, but it's going to be a multi-layered question. So I want to come back to Rwanda. So if we come back to Rwanda, you like you rightly said, in Africa we've had a mixed bag. We've had countries where the manipulation of constitution amendment have not been successful. I remember in Nigeria during the presidency of Obasanjo, they wanted to do extension totem, and you know that was successfully countered. But in Rwanda, with the 5 years, and you mentioned Paul Kagame also has another prospect of another 5 years after those 5 years. Yeah. So do you think his economic success will be enough. And then he's you know, adept. I know he's been adept at, you know, creating, intimidating opponents, you know, excluding opponents. Do you think this will be enough in the next 10 years to prevent the people from some kind of uprising that we've seen in places like Kenya, or we've seen in other places where you're seeing a large youth population? Africa has a very large youth population that are becoming mm-hmm. more aware now. Do you think there will be any kind of like protest or you know, strong resistance to mm-hmm. this kind of like consolidation of power, or hold strong grip on power by one person in Rwanda?
Yes, what we know from field research, I haven't done field research in Rwanda for many years because I'm banned. I'm not allowed into the country. They don't like criticism. But others have of course done field research. And what I see in their publications and when talking to them is that there is actually what is called a great deal of structural violence in Rwanda, meaning that's not visible, not acute violence, but frustration, feelings of marginalization, to some extent some despair. And yet, I don't think there will be a popular uprising in Rwanda. It's impossible. First of all, you don't have, unlike in a country like Kenya, you don't have a sizable middle class in Rwanda, because these uprisings in countries like, well, in places like Nairobi, for instance, recently, or in another place in Bangladesh, for instance, also recently, this is very much a middle class phenomenon. Students, for instance, or people working in services. Now, in Rwanda, the 80% of the population is rural. And so they would be, first of all, would be unable to organize themselves because they would be found out immediately, and the repressive machinery would start functioning immediately, including at the local level, where the security or intelligence services are present. There is something else that I think might happen in Rwanda, and again, it's very difficult. It's easy to predict the past, but it's very difficult
to predict the future.
But what I see as the most likely danger for Kagame is some sort of coup d'etat or trouble in the inner circle. And this is actually something that we've seen in Rwanda for, even in pre-colonial days, there was a lot of infighting in the royal court, with coup d'etats, with assassinations, with whole families being wiped out in those fights. And I can feel, and sometimes I mentioned the case of Patrick Karegeya, the former spy chief of Rwanda, but there's also a former chief of staff of the army, a former attorney general, a number of other people, Tutsi, who used to be RPF, who have fled the country and are now living or dead, like Karegeya, abroad. Now, that shows, of course, this looks like a monolithic regime, but of course, the fact that so many people flee the country, and I just mentioned a few, but there's an entire family, in almost an aristocratic family, that is abroad now. So there is, although it's not visible or not very visible, there is some, there are contradictions within the regime, in the inner circle, not in the government, because the government is just an administrative body. The real decisions are taken in a small inner circles of people, mainly having returned as refugees from Uganda. It's a pretty small group, and it's still very much a military group. Now, that, I think, is, and I'm sure Kagame realizes that very well, which in a sense also makes it very difficult to, even if Kagame wanted it, to provide for a successor. I mean, someone who were to say today, of that inner circle in the RPF, were to say today, okay, my ambition is to because Kagame says he wants a successor. He's been saying that for ages, for 20, not 20 years, but for over 10 years. And he has said one day, over 10 years ago, that if there's no successor, he would consider that a major policy failure on his part. And there's still no successor. And the problem is that if someone were to express that ambition, I'll rephrase that. They will not express that ambition for fear of being arrested or disappeared or having to flee abroad. So in other words, in that sense, the system is really blocked. I don't know whether someone will be in 2029, when the next elections, presidential elections take place, whether someone, whether we will be able to mention a name of someone who might be a possible successor to Kagame.
Interesting. We would see, like Riley said, it's easier to predict, like said the past, but the future it's difficult to predict. But it's quite interesting. It's an interesting time. It's quite I don't know, like the candidate that was excluded, like she said, you know, Kagame, we can't rule out the some of the gains that he's recorded, but again, without a successor, you know, if you hold on to power like that, that somehow will nullify some of those gains. But we're very grateful to have you join us today, and I'm very grateful for your very, very deep insight. I've seen some of your works. You've really done very interesting works over the years. We're very grateful to have you, Philip. Thank you very much, Philip.
Thank you for having me, Michael.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. Bye. Thank you very much for tuning in today to yet another exciting and interesting episode on the Rwandan genocide and autocratic democracies in Africa. Join me as usual to thank our Professor Philip Regents for his very rich insight and this rich conversation. As usual, I implore you to join me again next week for another interesting episode. Until then, stay blessed.